for another Thursday of Raising Serotonin. I am so hype. I really wasn't around much in December, but that's okay. We were just resting. It's a season of rest. That's what I talked about in my last podcast. But coming back, I obviously had to have my favorite guest ever. You are my, like, you came on 3 times now, and that's the most anyone's ever come on the podcast. So I'm just so thankful that you take the time to do this. I appreciate your knowledge and all your wisdom. So go ahead, tell us who you are.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on again. I really appreciate it. Yeah, my name is Saad. I'm a pharmacist based out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. By day, I manage a community pharmacy, specifically a CVS right now. And outside of that, I operate in the psychedelic medicine space. So I founded the company a few years back called Silo Health, where we're dedicated to the education, legislation, and integration of psilocybin-supported care. I also co-founded the Psychedelic Pharmacists Association. And the whole point of that is to educate all types of people about psychedelics, advocate for the need for pharmacists to be involved in the continuum of care of psychedelics for the purpose of safety and accessibility. And outside of that, I've just been, you know, trying to take care of myself and balance life and develop myself in different areas. I've been working on my jujitsu for the last year and a half now, and really love that. It's been really, really good for me.
Yeah.
I just recently got into climbing too, like bouldering. So
like real climbing,
not real climbing, like the fake plastic, you know, grip climbing, but it's been really good too. Just hitting different parts of my body. I didn't even know there was muscles there.
Right. And
it's really good for my grip strength too, which kind of bleeds over into the jujitsu world.
Awesome.
So that's a little bit amazing about what I've been working on. Yeah.
Well, I'm super glad about you're doing different things. That's also what I want to do in 2023. I have like this mindset of like, okay, I'm not going to just like stop myself of doing things that like are out of the norm, like just doing things that more people wouldn't normally do. And those are definitely two things not a lot of people do. So I'm proud of you for that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Where are you in professional career? Like, are you still happy with your job? Or are you looking to go somewhere else? Like, what's the goodness of that right now?
Yeah, I'm really happy with where I'm at right now.
Awesome.
It's always a challenge to balance the full-time work with the passion projects and the relationship and social life and all the things. Yeah. But we're doing it, and we're doing it well.
Good.
I really appreciate my pharmacy team. They've been absolutely tremendous to work with. Our patients, they could probably be a little more patient.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but all in all, it's good. It's all good, and very grateful for, you know, my partner and her patience with me as I, you know, focus on a lot of these other passion projects. And it's been really great and supportive. Great.
And how many years has your business been up and running now? Your foundation.
The Silo Health company that's been up since, like, we started our first group chat January of 2020. So almost 3 years of it being like a real thing.
Yeah.
So we're the team's developing and we're all happy and we're just figuring out the very next step. And we have a lot of awesome ideas, but it's just honing in on what we all feel is the most effective use of our time, just because we're all bootstrapping this right now. We have not accepted any investor money, and we're just trying to make sure we do this the right way.
Awesome. That's amazing. Well, I want to definitely get into talking more about all of this. So let's just get into it. So Saad has been on my podcast 2 other times, and I will link them in the show notes for you. And we really talk about psilocybin and serotonin and just making sure that we know everything that we can, as much as the knowledge is out there. So can we just talk about what psilocybin is again and what it does, what it's used for? Can you give us an overview of that?
Totally. So psilocybin is one compound found in the quote unquote magic mushroom. Psilocybin, when it's ingested, gets metabolized to what's called psilocin or psilocin. That's what's actually active. That's what activates the serotonin 2A receptors in the body to then induce the psychedelic experience. So we'll just say psilocybin to relate to psilocin in this conversation today. But what we're finding is that psilocybin is very safe. It's very effective. And it's been utilized for millennia in indigenous and different ceremonial contexts, dating back to like 10,000 BCE in the caves of southeastern Algeria, indicating that, you know, again, magic mushrooms or psilocybin cubensis mushrooms have been used in some style of spiritual like experiences and ceremony. So the safety record is proven. Now we're at a point of our species to where we are struggling extremely with our mental health and emotion. We have an emotional crisis at hand, and we're finding that, hey, let's look into the different tools out there that have been used for such a long period of time, being psilocybin. The FDA has already granted breakthrough designation status for psilocybin on two indications, one being major depressive disorder and two being treatment-resistant depression. So having had failed two lines of psychotropic medications for your depression. And we're anticipating the rollout of the legalization of synthetic psilocybin right around sometime year 2024. Next year in 2023, Oregon plans to have a officially accessible legal system for psilocybin services. That's going to be throughout the entire state of Oregon. And we're seeing a lot of other really cool policy initiatives taking place throughout the country regarding psilocybin and psychedelic reform.
I had no idea. That's so exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's also kind of challenging because, you know, when you bring in the legalization and almost pretty much the guarantee of profits, that's where the access is up for question. It's like, okay, how do we make sure this is accessible? How do we make sure this is sustainable? And then a lot of questions that come up are like, okay, like, who's going to be able to provide care? Is it only going to be clinicians, only going to be therapists, or can people who really care about others and are compassionate, can they also help out? Additionally, it brings up the questions of, okay, what about the natural fruiting body? Like that, the FDA isn't going to legalize that, mm-hmm. right? They're only legalizing the synthetic because that's how we can ensure, you know, dosing predictability. That's how we can, that's what pharmaceutical companies will be utilizing in their clinical trials. So there's a lot of questions up for air, but at the end of the day, it's great that there will be options, but the question is at what price, at what cost, and will there be more conversations about opening up access to, you know, again, the fruiting bodies, and how do we make sure that there's like reciprocity? There's all these questions right now. And if you get into the ecosystem at all, you'll realize that these are really important questions.
Right. Well, at least you have the questions. It's not like they're just doing something like without even talking about it. So that's so important too. But yes. I love that you brought up that psilocybin and mushrooms are used for depression, because that's kind of what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
And how mushrooms and can benefit, or specifically psilocybin can benefit for anxiety or depression. Is there studies on anxiety, or is it like solely depression right now?
It's both. So okay, cool. There's a lot of studies coming out. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence, of course, but then a lot of, you know, really hard clinical evidence as well. So I'll refer to, for anxiety, I'll speak about the Johns Hopkins work that was done. So Johns Hopkins enrolled terminally ill cancer patients who have like existential anxieties. And they provided them with psychological support from preparation to then having dose day support with two session monitors and then follow-up integration afterward. And what they found was a statistically significant decrease in clinical scores for anxiety and depression in those participants. And I think there were over 90 participants in that study. So over 90 people of the 90 people, a large percentage of them had sustained relief, not just a month out, 3 months out, but actually up to 6 months out after their one or two dose days. So when it comes to the potential benefits in alleviating symptoms of depression and anxiety, I get so excited because I'm like, wow, one or two dose days with caring, compassionate people. Yeah, you put in the work from the preparation phase. You have to face a lot of truths, you know, with yourself during the dose day, and then you do the work afterward. Mm-hmm. It's for me, it's just a completely different way to look at how we can support those struggling with their mental health. And it's much more sustainable for me, to me, than taking an antidepressant every single day.
Every single day. Oh my God. That's like another question I have. So like, you're just like blowing my mind right now. How similar would this be to take, or like taking a dose, like how similar would that be to taking an antidepressant every day? Like if you do that every single day for a year, but you only have to take one or two doses, I feel like you're right. It is a lot more sustainable, but what is the, do you think there is a huge difference, or you tell me?
Yeah, there's definitely overlap. I would say they're completely different. So here, let's start with where there's commonality. The overlap is that they activate the serotonin system, right? SSRIs work by inhibiting the reuptake of serotonin in the synaptic cleft so that it will increase serotonin throughout the brain. They work on the serotonin system again, specifically the serotonin, the 5-HT1 receptor system, which is different than where psilocybin and other classical psychedelics operate. They have their intended effects on the serotonin 2A receptors. Right. So although they both work on the same, they work on the serotonin system, they have completely different mechanism of actions, and they have different, and their therapeutic effect that's observed works on different receptor subtypes. So there's overlap, but there's differences. Okay. As you also mentioned, you know, based off the clinical trials, it's usually 1 to 2 doses of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. And that's it. After, you know, 3-6 months, there's still sustained relief. Whereas with SSRIs, it takes 2 to 6 weeks for any therapeutic effect to be observed. That therapeutic effect is what, 15 to 18% more effective than placebo and some of the clinical trials that were done back in the day. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole slew of side effects that happen because of the modulation of serotonin in the body.
Yep.
So there's overlap, but there's differences. And other differences here too. You know, I know that there's a big thing in with psychedelics and specifically with psilocybin is this idea of microdosing. So all the clinical trials that suggest the utilization of psilocybin for mental health, all of the clinical trials use macrodoses or high doses, not microdoses. Okay. There are some studies coming out suggesting the benefits for mood and emotional well-being with microdosing, but the jury's still out for that. It's just really hard to quantify microdosing because there's no concrete clinical trials out there right now studying
on microdosing.
Exactly. Yes. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence. There's a lot of online communities, support groups, a lot of psychedelic professionals, people who microdose and swear by it. And that's anecdotal evidence. And we should never, ever, you know, stray away from anecdotal evidence. But it's also, we just need to be very grounded in objective science whenever we're making claims about what can be therapeutic and what cannot be. Me personally, I think there's a lot of potential benefits with microdosing. I think that when it comes to being more user-friendly on people, it's great because, for example, people are used to taking a tablet a day, a capsule a day. With microdosing, it's very similar in that it's usually 1 day on, 2 days off, which is James Fadiman protocol. Or it'll be like 4 days on, 3 days off, which is the Paul Stamets protocol. So you have some type of like structured regimen or protocol to follow. So similar to how prescriptions are written. Additionally, when it comes to like the macro dose experiences, that's a lot of work. You know, you have to do a lot of preparation. It's usually done with some type of psychotherapist or someone that has the basics of non-directive support nailed. They're usually clinical professionals. So they usually do, you know, what, between I think like 12 to like 20 hours of preparation cumulative before the dose day. That dose day is pretty much an entire day off. They always recommend an easy day before and after the dose day as well, so people can really focus on their experience. And after that, it's a lot of integration work. So even though the outcomes are, I think, extremely promising. And again, we said 1 to 2 doses with 6 months to up to even 12 months of sustained relief. That's great. But who has the luxury of time? Not everyone. Not everyone has the luxury of being able to take off work a weekend. What if they have kids? How are they going to afford childcare, child support? What if you don't know anyone that's willing to work with you in your community from preparation to dose day support to integration? So there's a lot of like limiting factors for people that want to have large dose experiences. So that's where the convenience of microdosing comes into place, being that, oh, my morning routine. It's a Monday. Let me take a microdose. Awesome. I think I feel something. I feel better. And it's a sub-perceptual type of thing. So you're never really going to be like, oh yeah, wow. Yes, yippee, I got it. Cause that's not a microdose. That's too high of a microdose if you're feeling that way.
Yeah.
And then you go on with your normal day. Sometimes people will microdose and then they'll be in these flow states and they'll be like, oh wow, I forgot I microdosed today. No wonder I feel, you know, more optimistic right now. So it's a very subtle change in the subconscious that bleeds into the conscious.
I don't know if I asked you this before, but so if I don't take my medicine, oh, I feel it. Like I will feel it even like this long into it and even in the beginning. So is microdosing like that? Like, would they feel anything?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So no. So the nice thing about classical psychedelics is that there's no, like they don't act. So they work differently than your SSRIs, right? What you're referring to is having that break from your maintenance medication. That's what some folks call rebound dysphoria, to where like that feeling of unease or the emotional distress that comes back almost like tenfold sometimes if you don't take your dose. That's, you don't see that with microdosing. To be honest, I'm not sure exactly why when it comes to the 2A receptor you don't see that. So I can't speak to the science there.
Oh, good. That's okay. But that's interesting to know that it's not, you don't have that, because obviously they're different. Like you said, like there's the type one, type two, but I did not know if there would be same similar effects or not. But if someone wanted to start either macro or micro dosing, do you have any recommendations of where they could start?
Sure. And all these recommendations, of course, are under the lens, it's not a true recommendation, right? It's all under the lens of like risk reduction, educational purposes only, or when this is legal or fully decriminalized, or if you're in like Jamaica or, you know, Amsterdam, where you can source this appropriately. So we can start with macrodosing. Macrodosing, there's a handful of factors to take into consideration. So one, of course, is you have a risk assessment, like being one, am I psychologically ready to have this high dose experience? And two, am I pharmacologically ready, like physically, am I ready to have this experience as well? So managing the risks here are important, because if some folks have, you know, a lot of family history of schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and they're maybe they're in their mid-20s, where that may come up soon if they were to ever experience that. These are contraindications to psychedelic experiences, because they may exacerbate that or bring that out. And we want to be very cautious when working with those patient populations or those folks with those types of medical histories. Because we want to reduce as many risks as possible. We just don't know what to do with people that have that in their family history. So it's a very delicate subject, because it's a patient population that we need to work with, but no ethics committee is going to approve us studying psychedelics on those who may have a, you know, schizophrenic break or manic episodes. So having that in mind is important. Additionally, if you're on SSRIs or SNRIs or other types of psychotropic medications, there's the potential of either some side effects from happening, or, and specifically, the blunting of the psychedelic experience. So you want to be very aware of the expectations you put on the experience, especially if you have history or are currently on an antidepressant. So it's important to, like, you know, chat with a psychiatrist or a psychedelic pharmacist, if you know one, to ask for some advice or input there. The concern here is, again, not that you might overload your serotonin system, because there's actually no way for serotonin toxicity to occur if you're just mixing an SSRI with psilocybin. And I shouldn't say there's always something there potentially with science, but they work completely differently, that toxicity and these different medications mixing together. So the one thing that can happen, again, is what we call the blunting of the psychedelic experience. So if people are struggling so much and they put all this work into, you know, to getting all the factors right, and we'll talk about those factors for an optimal dose day. If they put all this work in and then they take X amount of grams of dried mushrooms and they don't feel a single thing. That can be very challenging. That can be very disheartening, especially when you put all this hope and these expectations for having this type of, you know, mystical like experience. If you're on these antidepressants, the reality is that you may have a blunted effect completely and you may not feel the psychedelic. Or if you do, it won't be to the factor that people really speak about when it comes to this feelings of oceanic boundlessness or ineffability and ego dissolution, ego death. So those are some things to consider when it comes to risk assessments. Okay.
If that happens, that's just going to cause more anxiety.
Right. Exactly. And it's just, it can be very disheartening for people, especially if this is like their last line, like this is the last thing they want to consider. They've been struggling for many, many years and they hear about this. And if they don't know that that's a reality, I mean, it can be very challenging for people to cope with that. So you have the risk assessment. Once risks have been assessed and expectations there are managed, you get into the preparation phase. So you really want to prepare for the experience. And that means a few things. It means setting open-ended intentions, again, not clear-cut, oh, I want to cure my depression. I'm going to do this and cure my depression. It's not like that. It's more just open-ended. It's more an invitation to explore maybe why I feel these feelings and open-ended intentions and like being open to receiving whatever comes up. You can also have some more clear intentions, being that you'd like to find relief, but just it's important that people go into the experience not assuming they're going to have this definitive complete resolve of their depression and anxiety, because that may not happen. Maybe it comes out and they're even more depressed and more anxious. Who knows? So the open invitation to just explore and invite all of the ideas that may come up during the dose day is important in that regard. You also want to optimize what's called set and setting. So that's your mindset and your physical environment going into the experience. So your mindset, that'll be, you know, journaling, for example, is really great for people that are preparing for the experience. Just stream of consciousness journaling, speaking about their journaling about their life, about their just journaling, whatever comes to mind, developing that relationship with the self and finding a way to let that unconscious bleed out into their reality. So journaling is a good one. Getting into some type of meditative routine is something that we recommend folks to do. Cleaning up their diet, getting into some type of physical exercise. Doesn't have to be anything crazy, but just enough to where like you're optimizing your mindset. You know, you're really trying to take this seriously. You're getting ready for it. And setting is that physical environment, that container. So if it's going to be your room, clean up your room, fold your clothes. You know, if you're going to be having this experience, you don't want to have dirty laundry all around you. You don't want dust settling on all the shelves. Like take care of your physical space. That also means limiting the amount of variables. So usually it's going to be phone off, phone away from you. You don't want to be trying to have this deep introspective experience and there's a house party happening all around you. It's hard to stay internal. Additionally, when it comes to the physical environment, generally the journeyers in the clinical trials will have a blindfold on and headphones in, listening to non-lyrical music. And then we really emphasize the importance of non-lyrical music because lyrics can bias the experience. Lyrics can have some it's just some triggers in it as well. So being able to have these non-lyrical journeying music, that can be really helpful for just like helping with the storyline and arc of the journey itself, for the insights to happen and go a little bit more organically. Some people don't even want music. Some people just put on no headphones or put on noise canceling headphones and it'll be strictly no stimuli at all. So those are some options that people like to pursue. Another really important thing is a sitter or a supporter, someone to be there during the dose day. That's so that way you can really find, essentially you can have like an anchor to the ship, if that makes sense. It's like you want to be able to trust in someone who you really feel comfortable with, who you care about, who they care about you, and they're there to witness your experience. They're not there to direct it. They're not there to guide it. They're not there to do anything that will bias it or make it as though the journeyer is not at the forefront of the experience itself. It's about just making sure that someone's there to take care of your physical body so that way you can explore your subconscious. You can explore what comes up internally to work through whatever intentions you've had or whatever reasons why you are, you know, trying to develop this higher relationship with yourself. So setting and support, like a peer supporter or a sitter, those are three big things there after risk management in that preparation phase to really iron out. If you have the luxury of someone in your community who wants to work with you, awesome. Get coffee with them, sit down, grab a bite, whatever, get to know them, build trust, build rapport, and work through the things together, have the experience. And then afterward, it's going to be integration. It's going to be talking about what happened. It's like, oh, wow. Like, you know, I saw XYZ and it reminded me of XYZ. And then, you know, these things happened. I felt this way. And just to get that out, just to process it verbally, whether it be one-on-one or in groups, goes a long way, especially if you're doing this with other people who have had psychedelic experiences or just generally curious or want to help develop you as an individual. It's a great way to work on the insights you had, because people can ask questions. Oh, like, what does XYZ mean to you? It's like, oh, like, it means that. And then you kind of put the pieces together to make more meaning. And it's a great way. I think for me, psychedelic integration is one of the most, is the most important aspect when it comes to sustainable psychedelic experiences and community building, because you're processing your experience in groups. But then on top of that, you are getting the perspectives and support and mindsets from all these other people who you trust or you care about to help well around how you make meaning from your experience versus having to have a journey every couple of weeks or every couple of months to get more insight. It's like you can get novel insight just by integrating your experiences more often, by talking about it and letting people ask you about it and sharing about it and trying to explore things that you've never been able to really fully verbalize. Because another factor of the psychedelic experience is that people call it, and it's ineffable, it's undescribable. But a lot of the fun and meaning happens when you try to describe what's indescribable. So those are a handful of factors to take into consideration for macrodose experiences.
Before you have your experience, like, is that, you said like it's a 1 or 2 day thing, or like, can it be like, sometimes it has to be like a month or 2 months, or like it can be like a time period before you actually like go into your experience?
Totally. Yeah. So before I was licensed, I did a lot of work in my community where the preparation phase would be between 3 weeks to a couple months. Let's say that's usually the range for at least how I've worked with people in my community. When it comes to the clinical trials, I think it would be right around the same timeline. I remember it was more about hours meant versus duration of like time of in that phase. So I can't really speak too much to how many weeks or months it took to get through those hours that they determined. But usually it's like in the teens of hours. I think Johns Hopkins, it was 16 hours of preparation work, which includes building rapport or trust with your medical monitors or those peer supporters, those quote unquote trip sitters, defining the dose day logistics, and a handful of all the other things I mentioned being setting intentions, expectations, roles, responsibilities. So there's a lot of awesome content to go through during the preparation phase. And again, to your question, yeah, right around 3 weeks to maybe a month and a half, 2 months of preparation is appropriate, but it's also very personal to the individual. Some people may take them half a year to a year to really be fully prepared to kind of do a deep dive into their own psyche and soul, right? Others, maybe they've already been doing this work on themselves for a while and they already are ready and they have someone who they care and who cares about them and they care about that they trust to support them. So they already have rapport, right? So maybe could be just a couple of days, as long as they hit those check marks and make sure that there's no clear-cut expectations of outcomes and that they're open to inviting all the things that come up and they follow this preparation, this facilitation, this dose day, having support, setting, controlling variables, and then integrating afterward. Usually that's a good recipe for success. But those are all asterisks, 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 because there's just so many, so much more there too.
So many other things that could happen, but
yeah,
I didn't know if maybe, because like, what if someone was, so for me, I'm tapering off my medication. So, but I'm still doing it really slowly because I'm mm-hmm. doing it at my own pace. So,
yeah.
Okay, so like, but what if during this time, like, oh, I decide, okay, I want eventually want to start to do that instead of being on this medication. I was wondering like, oh, like if like, oh, like I'm not ready. Like I can't do this in like 1 or 2 days, but when, if it did take like, okay, yeah, 6 months, like, oh, that's okay. That's more comforting to know. I don't know if I'm ever going to do that, but mm-hmm. it just knowing sure. Even if it does take me longer than the 16 hours or the 3 weeks, like if it did take longer, like that's comforting to know. Like it's a good process. It seems very like overall healing. And I hope that that's like the obviously the goal for everyone to learn how to heal, because no one wants to live with anxiety and depression. And having more options other than just a prescription that gives you so many side effects.
Yeah.
I can speak on that forever. Mm-hmm. Like I got the night sweats. If I don't take it, like I will, like my head pounds. Like it's like mm-hmm. I out of body experience. Like
yeah.
it's a thing. So I'm really glad that within like the next few years that this thing is just coming out and open. Like that thing being psilocybin is coming out and open, because I know like holistically, like there are things that we can do to prevent mm-hmm. depression and help relieve anxiety and moving forward. That's just really great, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, totally, me too. And yeah, I agree completely. It's what you said, so it's really about more options, right? Because mm-hmm. just so these are these antidepressants, although we kind of rag on them, right, they are necessary. They are very necessary for many people, and the issue is that this is the only option. But we should be happy that they are an option, right? Because at the end of the day, even though it's only 15 or to 18% better than placebo, it's 15, 18% better than placebo, right? If it's a way to passively cope versus actively cope, you know, which is what they call like psychedelics, is active coping. If you can passive cope to get through tough times in life, to then whenever you are ready to do the work, you can do the work. Heck yeah, all the power to you, you know? Some people just aren't able to. Right. Some people have, maybe they're a full-time student juggling a job, a social life, and they're just very confused about life and where and family and culture and community. Maybe they don't want to think about more things. They having the option to get what you need to get done now, so that way later on, when you're ready, if you're ready, if you even want to get off this, you can. I'm glad that there are antidepressants out there for those reasons. But again, going back to the initial point, is like, we need more options. Like, what about the people that want to do the work? You know, like, what, like, how can we better meet them where they're at, especially with something that's shown to be safe, you know, when it comes to addictive potential, when it comes to toxic levels. There's no lethal dose of psilocybin mushrooms ever recorded, but you can't say that with over-the-counter aspirin, and you can buy that for $3 over in any drugstore. So yeah, there's a lot there.
Options are important, and just when I definitely got on my medication, there was no other option. It was like, okay, you're going on, well, we're going to try this medication, and then I had to go through all of the things to find a medication that worked for me. But I don't know, like if I'm willing to do that, like and go through that period, maybe in like a few years, I'd be willing to try something else. So I'm just glad that more is coming open and into the mental health world, because we need that back.
I do need to channel the inner pharmacist in me and talk about risks of these things. So we spoke predominantly on macro doses and large dose experiences. So of course we mentioned some of the risks there, but I do want to talk about microdosing a little bit, just because it's a very convenient, more user-friendly way to consume psychedelics. And there are potential risks of microdosing. And the main one that I want to speak about is this idea called valvular heart disease. So we haven't seen it yet. It's a theoretical risk, but it's something that people should be aware about, because it's their lives, it's their health, it's their decisions. They needed to know about all the potential benefits and risks associated with what they put in their body. So when it comes to valvular heart disease, we bring this up because of what's called the serotonin 2B receptor. So we speak about the serotonin 2A receptor being the reason why you have a psychedelic experience. The 2B receptor, when that's activated and stimulated pretty repetitively, it can actually cause, you know, again, valvular heart disease. Through that's done with like the mitral regurgitation, and that can lead to pulmonary hypertension and death. That's never been seen with psychedelics, to my knowledge, and based off of the articles I've read, it hasn't been observed. The theoretical risk there is that back in the day, there was a drug on the market called fen-phen or dextroamphetamine. It was pulled from the market because it activated the 2A receptor, or the 2B receptor, excuse me. It activated the 2B receptor. And in those patients that consumed this weight loss drug, 25% of them ended up getting valvular heart disease. And a lot of the times it leads to the need for invasive surgery. And then this also may potentially cause death. So the way we can reduce the risks of valvular heart disease, again, it's a theoretical risk, is really just cycling of the microdosing regimen. So people, when they microdose, they usually recommend 4 to 5 weeks on, 4 to 5 weeks off, and then maybe repeat if you need. What they find is that over time, microdosers generally tend to microdose even less frequently. So they usually follow a protocol to begin with, which is a Stamish protocol or a Fadiman protocol. And that's usually cycled 4 or 5 weeks on, 4 or 5 weeks off. What they find again is that over time, people tend to microdose less and then completely stop. I like to think it's because people recognize that all they need has been inside them all along, but they just needed to really feel it subconsciously a bit more. So yeah, that's the thing I really wanted to make sure I check mark on our discussion today. Because as much as it's really exciting to talk about all the great and the good and the amazing things that psychedelics can potentially offer, we do need to be very careful when it comes to, you know, what's it called? Like drinking the psychedelic Kool-Aid. Like there are risks, right? There are risks, there are potential repercussions. And if you want to mitigate those risks with microdosing, don't do it chronically, cycle on and off. And then if you have a cardiologist, if you have the ability to access one, get an echocardiography done or echocardiogram done in between cycles. So that way you can just make sure that nothing is funky in the heart. So that's the last thing I wanted to share.
That's great. Well, thank you for that. Cause I didn't even know you were supposed to cycle on and off.
Yeah, I've talked to people who say that they've been microdosing every day for the last few years, and I like my blood pressure ticks up like, you know, a little bit. I'm like, oh gosh, like I hope everything's okay. And then like they have to, and the thing that sucks too about if you microdose every day is your 2A receptors, like you have to match them in terms of the regulation that they have because you're activating it so much. So you can't have the precise dosing. You have to actually dose yourself more and more and more because those receptors build tolerance very quickly, right? And there's no come down from it. There's no, like, again, there's no withdrawal effect from stopping it, but it's just tough to predict what the microdose will be like if you don't cycle on and off, if you don't take breaks in between dose days as well. So those are some things there to just be aware about. Oh yeah.
Awesome. Where can my people find you if they want to come talk to you? If they have questions about anything, tell us where they can reach out to you.
Yeah, I've had a couple of people reach out to me on Instagram, actually, after listening to some of our previous episodes. So I really appreciate that. And if people just want to reach out to me that way, I mean, please feel free to. I can share my email address as well. I'm active on LinkedIn, too, so they can connect with me on LinkedIn. Additionally, on our Silo Health website, they can subscribe to that and stay updated with any of our upcoming events or offerings. And we're going to be active, very much more active in 2023 than we were over the last couple months following the launch of our program. So yeah, there's a handful of ways there. And was that your entire question? Did I answer that?
Yeah, I will put everything about you in the show notes so they can find your Instagram, your LinkedIn, your website, all the things. Cool. I appreciate you taking your time today to do this. I really learned a lot, and I always learn a lot when you talk. So I appreciate you and your knowledge, and I am looking forward to this episode coming out tomorrow.
Always happy to help. And whenever you want to chat about anything else, let me know.
I always will. Cool. All right.